McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, we're going to be exploring a wonderful baseball story that is very much out of the ordinary. And it concerns a wonderful new book called The Wax Pack. 15 picture cards, one stick bubblegum on the open road in search of baseball's afterlife. This is the story of Brad Baloukjian, a rabid baseball fan for all of his life, and someone who, back in his childhood, loved to collect baseball cards. And as an adult, he decided it would really be fun to return to the thrill of opening up one of those packets of baseball cards for the very first time. And so he decided to purchase one off of eBay, and then, more amazingly, decided to pursue those baseball players who were featured in that particular set of cards, and set off on an extraordinary journey that took him through 30 states over the course of 48 days, more than 11,000 miles. It was an incredible journey, and he writes about it in this terrific book published by the University of Nebraska Press. Brad Baloukjian, by the way, is director of the Natural History and Sustainability Program and teaches biology at Merritt College in Oakland, California. And as a freelance writer, his work has appeared all over the place. But we are talking today about his book, The Wax Pack, on the open road in search of baseball's afterlife. Brad Baloukjian, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you for having me on, Greg. Glad to be here.
Your baseball book opens, actually, with these words. Baseball is very much a game about fathers and sons, as the following pages attest. And then you go on to say, my gratitude to my dad will hopefully speak for itself, but I want to use this space to thank my mom. For every game my dad took me to, my mom took me to a baseball card shop in some converted garage or basement in rural Rhode Island to indulge my passion. I'm so glad that you do that. I think that's such a sweet way to begin the book. Was that kind of a last-minute thought, or right from the start did you realize that you needed to be grateful to both of your parents for their part in this wonderful exploit?
Well, yeah, I've always felt very privileged that I grew up with such a loving childhood and, you know, with such loving parents that were so supportive. And as I wrote the book, I think I did write that at the end, you know, after I had written the whole book. And I was thinking about the whole thing. And clearly, not just my own relationship with my dad, which is explored in the book because he joins me on one leg of the trip, but that became a theme throughout the book that I didn't even expect going in, the father and son connection. And it's not just the father-son relationship field of dreams way where it's, you know, this wonderful thing. I mean, there's a lot of really sad and kind of traumatic stories in the book as I meet the players and hear their stories of their relationships with their fathers. And so that whole theme really took center stage in the book, and yet when I really thought about how the book is very much also my own story, and I can't really tell my story without my mom being acknowledged because, you know, she played such an instrumental role in everything for me. So I thought, I needed to find a way to acknowledge that.
Right. I really love the way you describe your relationship with your father in the 12th chapter of the book, and I think you're really probably speaking on behalf of a lot of guys when you write, "My dad took me to countless ball games as a kid. My memories of those times are a collage of senses. The smell of sausage, pepper, and onions from a vendor outside Fenway Park, a sandwich my dad had to have before every game, his hairy legs outstretched next to me in the bleachers, the steady calm of his voice as he explained how to score a game. Whatever we lacked in common ground or understanding, we made up for with baseball." Can you just speak for a moment about that last line and maybe describe for us your relationship with your dad and how that relationship, in a sense, was especially strong and centered when the two of you could, in a sense, come together around the great game of baseball?
Well, I've been asked a lot, you know, what is it about baseball that makes it such a touch point with fathers and sons? And I think, really, it's, you know, my relationship with my dad, I think, like a lot of men of, you know, I'm sort of Generation X, and my dad's a baby boomer, and, you know, that generational, you know, navigating that relationship, I think a lot of the baby boomer generation, especially, there's a lot of men have had a hard time expressing their feelings, sort of overtly just in general, and also to their sons. And so with my dad, whenever we spend time together, we're very close, but I don't feel like we get into a lot of the really, you know, deeply personal things about our feelings. And so, we, you know, we're talking about the stock market and politics and sports, but, you know, we could spend a whole week together and not really get into some of the more personal stuff. And, you know, that's over the years, I've sort of wrestled with that because I'm someone who's very much likes to talk about my feelings and to kind of really communicate in that way. But, you know, I've had to accept that my dad is just not like that. And I can't force him to be somebody he's not. And so I think the value of baseball when you have relationships like this is that it's a way for people, or especially men, to express their feelings without having to do it, you know, verbally or overtly. You know, the act of playing catch, the act of going to a baseball game, of explaining the game, because baseball is so slow and sort of plodding, it just provides a lot of time. You know, I mean, in an age now where time feels so limited, baseball is still, you know, a 3-hour game. And I think that's the beauty of it, is that when you sit down to take one in, you're committing to a long stretch of time to be together. And to me, that's, you know, why it resonates so much in the father-son relationship.
Very well said. That reminds me, too, of an interesting observation that you make earlier in the book, when you're actually not talking at this point at all about the relationship that boys and their fathers have around baseball, and I suppose some daughters and fathers for that matter too. But anyway, but around the question of the pace of the typical baseball game, at one point you write this: "Baseball has always been the most mental game, simply because there's so much time to think. Each pitch is followed by a 20 to 30 second gap in which the brain can betray the body in dozens of different ways, while sports with more continuous action like basketball and hockey rely more on pure instinct. Until fairly recently, mental troubles were treated with a simple dismissive prescription: get over it. But as baseball's wealth grew from big to obscene, executives began to see the importance of players' psyches and their direct correlation with performance." This happens to be a chapter where you're talking about one of the baseball players you got to talk to, who is now a sports psychologist. But that pace of the game that you are talking about here really does set it apart, doesn't it, from all of our other major sports?
Yeah, you know, and I actually think baseball is always trying to, you know, fight to become relevant, or to stay relevant and to compete with those other more fast-paced sports. And I think, in a way, baseball should just accept that it is different, that it is slow. You know, instead of trying to find every possible way to shave 5 minutes off the average game, just accept that you're a long, slow game. And there are benefits that come with that. You know, there are advantages to baseball being slow. And I think that the people that really enjoy the game don't really mind that it has that pace. And so, You know, I think there's a lot to be said for taking advantage of the time and the space that the pace of the game provides.
We're speaking with Brad Baluchian and talking with him about his book, The Wax Pack, On the Open Road in Search of Baseball's Afterlife. Let's talk for a moment about your own lifelong love of baseball, and then we'll get specifically into the matter of your rabid collecting of baseball cards. But first, tell us about this game and how much you loved it as a spectator versus loving it as someone who wanted to play the game as well.
Well, growing up in Rhode Island, at a very young age, my dad introduced me to the game, which, you know, showed me how to read a box score in the newspaper. And I'll keep in mind, this is all in the mid-80s before the internet, and so information was limited. And so my connection to understanding the game, I always was a very analytical kind of person that liked to read a lot. And so my source of information was the baseball cards, primarily. I mean, there's so much information crammed on the back of those cards with all their statistics and, you know, various biographical data. And so those cards were my way of really getting to know the players. And then also in the newspaper, you would have every once a week and every Sunday, I remember there would be in the sports section, they would actually print all the up-to-date statistics of the players from that season. And it was this, you know, Sunday was a big day for me because that's the day I could actually find out how the players were doing. I mean, even when you watched a game on TV back then, they really didn't put the guy's statistics up there. You know, it was very simple graphics. You just get the score of the game at the end of the inning, but you didn't have the 24/7 access to everything you have now. And so I studied the players. I studied the game. I was a little unusual in that my favorite players were not the star players. And that's one of the other themes of the book. And in some ways, why I chose the device of a single pack of baseball cards to write about these guys from that time, because I knew that in any given pack of cards, most of the players would be those types of journeymen, bench warmer underdogs that I idolized as a kid. And it would give me a chance to write about those guys. They called them the common cards, the guys, you know, whose cards were not worth anything. And to most people, those were the cards they didn't want. They were just filler. And to me, they were actually the goal. You know, so I actually had a whole album full of these common cards that were my favorites. Mm. And so, that was sort of how, I mean, I recognized my limited athletic ability pretty early on. So I didn't get past Little League in terms of playing, but it didn't matter to me. It wasn't about playing the game. It was just something about, you know, being a fan and a student of the game that I really enjoyed.
Tell us about Greenville Pharmacy.
Well, it's funny, right now I live in Oakland, California, but I'm actually back in Greenville, Rhode Island right now as we speak, because it's a beautiful time of the year to be in New England, and I can work remotely with the pandemic situation. And so Greenville Pharmacy was, you know, Greenville is a town of about 5,000 in rural Rhode Island, and, you know, you had the one local pharmacy down the street, and so I would take my allowance, you know, every week, couple of quarters, and go down to the Greenville Pharmacy, and that's where you would buy the wax packs of baseball cards. And so it was, you know, a treat every week or so to get a pack, maybe if I was lucky, two packs of cards. And then what I loved about the experience was that you have 15 individual surprises in that pack, and I would really kind of draw out the experience and go through the cards one by one to reveal who was there.
Mm-hmm. And you say my childhood heroes were the journeymen and bench warmers, the underdog fringe players who needed to work like mad just to stay in place. And you counted yourself as something of an underdog in some respects as well. So that connection makes a lot of sense. Explain more then about what you would typically do. You write, even at that young age, I was not content to just let my cards sit in an album. I wanted, needed to know everything I could about the players themselves to connect with them in some way. Explain to our listeners the lengths to which you would go in pursuit of as much knowledge as you could find, as much information as you could find out about the players you had on these cards.
Well, I discovered pretty early on how you could actually get this book, remarkable book that was compiled of all the home addresses of every player that had ever played Major League Baseball. And this was for autograph collectors. And then I realized that if you sent a letter to a player and you included a self-addressed stamped envelope, that more often than not, they would actually sign your card and send it back in the mail. And so to an eight-year-old, this is just a goldmine of, oh, my, you know, I can actually get autographs. I mean, first of all, getting mail at age eight is a big thrill. Second of all, getting mail with a signed baseball card in it is, you know, just fantastic. And so I started sending cards to these guys that were these common guys, these, you know, these journeyman players, because to try to get their autographs. And then I realized, and maybe this is sort of the roots of being a journalist, is, oh, wait, I can not just send the card, but I could come up with like a questionnaire that I could include that in the mailing, and then ask them to fill that out and send it back to me with you know, their information. So I started to think, well, what am I interested in knowing? And so I had this little questionnaire that I wrote out that said, you know, who was your favorite player as a, you know, growing up, and who was your favorite, what was your favorite team? And then again, because this is all pre-internet, I was curious. I mean, even then, by now I'm probably, you know, 10, 11 years old. I was curious, what are they doing now? Like, you know, a lot of these guys who had already retired, and you had no way of knowing, you know, what were they doing after baseball? And so I'd write a little, have a question that said, you know, what job are you doing now? And I would send that along. And so I would start to collect information about these guys, and, you know, more personal information. And it was just to me, I mean, I think I've always been I'm a lifelong learner, and I just, that curiosity is what fuels all the work that I do. And so even at that age, I was wanting to know more than I could just get from a baseball card.
Hmm. And of course, you talk about how as you got older, your pathological need to scrutinize and document only grew, and it's one of the reasons why you became a scientist. Tell us at what point in your life you got this kind of interesting idea of returning to your baseball card craze, that is, to have that experience one more time of opening up a pack of baseball cards, as you had so many times in your childhood. And at this point in time, was this something that was still readily available, or were these no longer being sold to the public in standard stores?
Well, I have the at the beginning of every chapter, I have a quote from, usually from the player that the chapter is about. In the very first chapter of the book, the quote says, are you ready to grow up? And they said, it's from all my ex-girlfriends ever. And so, you know, there's this thing that I've thought about as an adult of that really the things that I'd loved as a kid, I never stopped loving, which, you know, usually you think you kind of grow out of these interests that you have as a kid. And I can remember professional wrestling. I loved islands and the ecosystem of islands. And even to this day, I've continued to pursue those things and be interested by them. And so the notion of kind of revisiting childhood interests, in some ways, it's not even a revisit. It's like I never left that. I never stopped thinking about those guys. I just got to a stage in my life, you know, I just finished my PhD and I was teaching part-time and I wanted to continue my writing career. And I said, you know, I'd always wanted to have the space to write something long. I mean, I was trained in magazine journalism, in the tradition of the new journalism of Tom Wolfe and Hunter S. Thompson from the 60s and 70s, and I always, you know, wanted a chance to write something long, and then that basically means a book nowadays. And so I started thinking about what would work as a book, and I started, and I was aware that, you know, to your question, they had stopped producing those wax packs back in like 1992. They still make baseball cards, but it's a much different hobby than it used to be. There was something about the pack that to me resembled a book, you know, the shape, the 15 cards, 15 chapters, and the random element of, you know, not knowing who's going to be in the pack. I mean, rather than cherry pick 15 guys that I wanted to write about, I liked the idea of being at the mercy of chance. And there's a lot to be said, I think, for restraints or constraints, I should say, in that, you know, I like to say I didn't choose the players, the player or the pack chose me. And I like this notion of, I think, to get a little bit meta here for a second, that's kind of one of the main themes of the book is to learn to let go of a need to control everything in our lives. You know, the book is very much about kind of a self-help book as much as it is a baseball book, because it talks a lot about psychology and the role of fear in our lives. And I think something that comes out through my conversations with these players is that, you know, the way to the sort of the path to contentment in your life is to realize you can only control so much, and, you know, to basically learn to let go of that need to control everything. And so back to the idea of the pack, I like the idea that, you know, I wasn't in control so much as the pack, you know, was just this random selection.
Hmm. So you send away to eBay. Do you happen to recall how much money you had to spend to get this particular pack of Topps baseball cards, which, by the way, you wanted to get them from 1986 because you thought that was the year you started collecting. So was this a lot of money you had to lay out for this?
No. No, this is a very low-budget part of the process. And because so many collectors saved their packs back then thinking that they were going to be worth a ton of money. And right around that time in 86, the cards were so overproduced, mass produced, that really they're not really worth much now. So I probably spent like $4 or $5 to get a pack. You know, that wasn't very expensive.
Hmm. I want to read, if you don't mind, the paragraph where you describe the experience of receiving this pack in the mail and opening it up.
Sure.
If you don't mind. When the pack, now a proper noun, arrives a few days later, I cradle its still shiny wax paper, admiring the sunbursts of gaudy color and nonsensical slogan, the real one, noticing the way the horizontal bar of the lowercase t in the name Topps extends farther than it should. I remove the calcified stick of gum with the caution of a bomb expert, place it in my mouth, and clench down on its powdered surface, splintering it into 1,000 crumbs, which instantly dissolve on my tongue. It's delightfully gross. I draw out the unveiling process as long as possible, slowly revealing each player while cherishing the mustiness of neglect. It is a tantalizing mix of greatness and mediocrity. 14 wax packers in all. Card 15 is a checklist, a card that is literally a list of the other cards. Of course, for me, it's not enough to just open the pack. Now I need to find the players inside it and write a book about it. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Brad Baloukchian, and we're talking about his book, The Wax Pack, On the Road in Search of Baseball's Afterlife. So at what point was it in that moment that you decided, I need to try to meet all of these players and write a book about that experience? Or when did the project itself sort of emerge from this step back into the past?
No, I had the idea first. I had the idea that that a pack would serve as a great device to write a book. And so by the time I had the pack in hand, the idea was fully formed in terms of, you know, knowing that I wanted to find these guys and track them down and turn it into this travelogue. So at that point I knew sort of where I was headed. I just didn't know kind of the themes in the whole story yet.
Mm. One of the things that was going to make this tricky was that these wax packers, as you call these 14 players, were spread out across the country. But beyond that, one challenge was, in a sense, who you were. You write, "I have no special connections, no rich uncle who was golf buddies with George Steinbrenner. I don't even have a sports writing pedigree to give me legitimacy. So I resort to good old-fashioned stalking." And, of course, that's the remainder of the book, in a sense, is a detailed chronicle of your efforts to try and meet 13 of these 14 players, the 13 players who were still alive, and to try to make some kind of connection with the one player, Al Cowens, who had already died. Tell us a little bit about the logistics, the nuts and bolts of putting this trip together. I mean, in the terms of the planning that you did at the outset, I mean, how strictly did you map this out?
Well, I think anyone that's ever fantasized about what it would be like to track down some hero of theirs will appreciate this book, because I mean, this is actually what I did, and they can live vicariously through that. But in terms of the mechanics, it's it was about 9 months of prep before I left, in which I took out my road atlas and I found out where everyone lived, and I kind of had an idea of the general route. But then I had to try to contact all the guys and tell them what I was doing. And so I started out with writing them letters. I mean, just kind of the same thing I did when I was a kid, you know, write them a letter and explaining who I was and what I was doing, and then follow that up with a phone call. A lot of times, thankfully, these players still have landlines, and so I would, you know, just put in a cold call. And I was, you know, really impressed with how many of them, or most of them, were said, "Well, if you're gonna come to my town, yeah, I'm happy to meet up with you." And then I had to do, you know, substantial research on all these guys, because even though I was a fan of that era, I wasn't necessarily, you know, a fan of all these guys. Didn't really know their careers in depth, so I put together a file on every player and, you know, read everything I could about their career from old newspapers and magazines, and tried to identify, you know, in the limited time that I would have with each guy, what would be the best topics to try to bring up. And, you know, I tell people that if you're looking for a book that just recounts old baseball heroics and games, you know, don't buy this book, because it's really not that type of book. It's not a baseball book per se. It's much more about the human side of being a baseball player. And so I think part of why I was able to connect so deeply with a lot of these guys is because I approached it from that angle, and that I wasn't asking them to rehash the same old stories, which they've told 1,000 times. I was going in with trying to extract more, you know, more of that personal information about their relationships and who they really are.
By the way, at the end of what kind of amounts, well, it's the first chapter of the book where you are kind of laying the groundwork for this, you spell out what your plan is. You write this: "When I encounter each new wax packer, I will hand him a thick manila folder, a collection of all the articles written about him in the sports media. I will say, 'This is my file on you. I've read it all, and I still feel like I know nothing about you.' He will smile and chuckle, impressed that I am willing to call him out on the well-known fact that players are trained to say nothing of substance to journalists. 'What do you want to know?' he will ask. 'You're about to find out.'" Is that sort of how this ended up playing out? I mean, did you, in fact, through your research, amass like manila folders full of stuff about all of these players? And was there something sort of like this moment at the outset of the conversations that did take place?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's all literal. I mean, I did have an actual folder on each guy, and I would put it in front of them and do exactly what I mean. Maybe not every single player, but several of them. And that was their reaction. I think they were kind of amused I established that I had done my homework, which, you know, I think when you're interviewing somebody, if the subject of the interview knows that you've invested time and done your homework, they respect you more. And then that I said, you know, this is not going to be your typical interview. I think at least prepared them to, think that I was going to have a different approach. Hmm. And again, there with a couple of small exceptions, the guys didn't really shy away from questions that were pretty, pretty personal. Hmm.
You tell us that the very first of these Wax Packers that you got to meet and interview, a player by the name of Rance Mullenix, is that how you pronounce his last name?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You say Rance is the perfect leadoff hitter for this journey. Wonderfully pedestrian as a player, but phonetically unforgettable. Tell us more about why it was great to start this adventure with him.
Well, I think, so this book is really, it's a narrative, it's a story. It's got a beginning, a middle, and end. And, you know, when you have a narrative, you want there to be a sort of emotional ebb and flow to the story. And I just got lucky in a lot of ways that the chronology of encounters that I had with these players ended up working out nicely emotionally in terms of the reader's experience. And so Rance begins the book, and he's a very just down-to-earth, steady type of, you know, he was... The type of person he is matched the type of player he was, just reliable, steady. And so we have this really, you know, kind of wholesome experience where he, you know, he takes me, I meet his family and his kids, and he gives me a hitting lesson. And, you know, he talks about his, you know, he lives in the town he grew up in. And, you know, it's a very, you know, just kind of sets a nice control for the book. And you kind of, you know, get this good solid footing going in. Okay, things are going well. And then, you'll see that, you know, about halfway through the book, I start to, you know, have some challenges where guys are not going to talk to me, or they blow me off, or, you know, and I start to, you know, deal with, okay, well, what do you do when things don't go well, right? And you have these setbacks. And then the book, I think, finishes strong with a couple of guys that, that I had really good encounters with. And so I say that he ended up being a great way to lead off, because it kind of, you go into the narrative with a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm, and then it kind of sets you up for what inevitably is going to happen later on. You know, just like in a movie, you know, you start strong and you know there's going to be some dramatic tension or conflict that's going to, you know, take you a different way, and then hopefully you end up with the resolution in the end.
Right. One of the things that I really love about the way you explore the career of Rance Mullenix is when you say Rance learned the lessons of failure early and often. I mean, this is someone who did not have monumental gifts, and you write, always forced to compete for playing time, he was never afforded the luxury of feeling comfortable. I really appreciate you taking the time to do that, because I think for a lot of us who are not a part of the game and don't study it the way that you have, I don't think a lot of us would really appreciate the life of some of these players who are fortunate enough to be in Major League Baseball and yet have, in a sense, a very sort of tentative place in that game. And that's a lot to live with. That sense that this game I just played could be my last with this team. I mean, it's important to appreciate that.
It's a very tenuous existence for most guys, and I think, as you said, we don't always appreciate that, because, you know, professional sports it's a really interesting study in identity, because for most of their upbringing they are the best on the field. But then as they get to each level, you know, or they get to the highest level, most of them are suddenly not the best. And, you know, there's a lot of people better than them. And so you go from being this, you know, star to being, you know, maybe not one of the, maybe one of the weaker people on the team. And I don't know that there's that many analogs to that in other facets of life or other professions where you have to really, and this goes back to why the mental part of the game is so important, because if you don't know how to navigate that change in your identity, you're not going to last very long. And the type of mental exploration, resilience, you know, that you need to stay at that level is significant. And it's why I actually think that kind of the next frontier of baseball advantage, you know, the competitive advantage is going to come more from this mental side of the game. That the players that are really able to have that mental edge are going to, you know, maximize their performance.
Hmm. I want to make sure our listeners understand. I mean, you've said it repeatedly, but I think it bears repeating that this book, while you do explore, of course, what these baseball players did in the game and out on the diamond and in the clubhouse and so on, you also are exploring more personal aspects of their lives, or at least in just about every instance in which these players are willing to go there. You know, that, and for instance, we learn from Rance Mullenix about the end of his marriage a couple of years after his baseball career ended, and he was just not sufficiently present. He says at one point, "You can be home and a mile away." That's an interesting way to, you know, kind of describe it. But what I want to ask you about is towards the end of your last interview with him, when he says this to you, "I didn't know coming in how this was going to go, but it's been a great experience for me. I'd love moving forward to have the opportunity to get together again or just reconnect, talk on the phone, to stay connected. He asks me if I have Facebook. I feel giddy. A few days ago, Rance was another hero from my childhood, and now he wants to be pen pals." I mean, I'm sure you just had to, like, pinch yourself that you could have a moment like this with a former Major League Baseball player.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that I mean, it's hard to, we overuse the word surreal, but that is the best way I could describe that feeling of that connection I had with him, which, again, I think when you it's funny, I don't actually think often enough about that chapter, because I think I often forget about also how much is packed in there, because I don't know, some reason I get asked more about the later parts of the book. But, you know, bringing that up, the Rance chapter really is kind of a microcosm of a lot of the themes that happen, that come up later on. And I think that it does, it did kind of also spoil me, in that, again, it, without even realizing it, it's sort of foreshadowing that things are going to not always be that great. And when I get into some of the players that, you know, struggle with drug addiction, or, you know, just sort of grumpiness and too much celebrity, and they're more elusive in the middle of the book, I think back to that Rance encounter, and it's like, I mean, it's just the contrast, which, you know, I tell people, these guys are all professional baseball players, but they're really no different than any other occupation. I mean, if you did a study of journalists, or a study of teachers or stockbrokers, like, some of them are going to be jerks. Some of them are going to be good guys. You know, it's like that variation is no different because they were all baseball players.
Well put. We're speaking with Brad Baluchian about his book, The Wax Pack: On the Open Road in Search of Baseball's Afterlife. One of my favorite moments in the book, interestingly enough, has nothing to do with baseball specifically, but it's a moment when you talk about the city of L.A. And we should say that Oakland, California, is a city that means a lot to you. You call it an underdog in its own right, which is probably one of the reasons you feel such close affinity for it. And L.A., very, very different. L.A. is a city on steroids, a gleaming monument to excess, and its consistently sunny weather notwithstanding, a terrible place to be poor. Reminders of what you don't have are everywhere. And Los Angeles is where you attempt to connect with Steve Yeager, a very, very different player from the first one that you met. Tell us what made this such a memorable encounter.
Yeah, it very different, and yet the common theme between those two chapters and many of the rest is vulnerability. And that is, I think, the word that encapsulates the meaning of the whole book is vulnerability. Because Yeager, again, from having done my homework, comes across in the newspaper accounts as this brash, kind of cocky, outspoken, you know, man's man that, you know, is just sort of a tough guy. And so I, and the kind of a carouser and a drinker, and, you know, party animal. So I'm thinking, okay, you know, this is the same way that Rance, living in the Central Valley in California, sort of salt of the earth, kind of his personality matches the place. I thought Yeager's personality perfectly matched Hollywood and L.A. And I get there, and I find him at the Jersey Mike sub shop where that he owns. And, you know, within a bit of meeting him, he tells me he hasn't had a drop of alcohol in 20-some years. And so my whole expectation or picture of this guy being this party guy is completely dashed immediately. So I had to kind of really reset. And when I got to spend time with him, I found him, yeah, he's still kind of this, you know, confident guy. But what was most impressive was that he let his guard down enough to share with me some really kind of sad and personal things about his father and his father being an alcoholic and how embarrassed he was of his father coming to one of his first major league games that he saw and getting so drunk that he passed out in the clubhouse. And so, you know, those moments are what really stand out the most to me from that chapter.
Hmm. And I think one of the most striking sentences in that whole chapter is when you kind of explain why Yeager loved playing baseball so much. On the playing field, you say, his dad couldn't hurt him. I mean, right. There was, in a sense, a safety out on the baseball field. I want to be sure that I give you a chance to talk for a moment about kind of the turbulent life and career of Gary Templeton. And this is where the matter of race enters the picture. He is African-American, and he experienced some real ugliness in his career. And I suspect this was tricky for you to explore with him and also to write about.
Yeah, it was. Templeton was a guy who had all the natural talent. I mean, it was so, the game came so easy to him that a lot of people, you know, criticized him and thought he was not giving effort. That he was being lackadaisical, and he said, "No, I'm not being lackadaisical. It just comes smoothly and easily to me." And so he was really highly touted, and came up in the St. Louis Cardinals organization in the 70s. And you know, when it comes to race and baseball and the history of that, we often hear about Jackie Robinson and integration in the 40s, but I think we often kind of gloss over that, oh, okay, once it was integrated, then, you know, things are fine. And, of course, there was a long shadow cast with the whole issue, and it was really difficult to come up and be a black player in baseball in the 70s. There was still so much racism. And so Templeton had this incident with his manager in 1981 where he got booed by the crowd because they thought he was loafing on a play, and he ends up flipping off the crowd and getting ejected and suspended, and this whole thing that kind of follows him the rest of his career. And then when you really dig into that story, I mean, I went back and really studied all the media reporting, but also got to talk to Gary himself when I met up with him near San Diego about what happened. And when he gives you the full context of the whole thing, it's just a completely different picture that emerges. And I felt really bad for him that he had been, he had sort of earned this reputation very unfairly. And really what set him off that day was these fans, you know, yelling racist things and calling him the N-word and all kinds of awful things.
Hmm. I also appreciated the story of Jamie Kuchenhauer, in part because he had played for a time with the Brewers, who are just up the road from us. And you, among other things, describe how this son of missionaries enjoyed the sport itself, but not the culture around it. And that discomfort was part of what kind of cut his career short. I want to finish in our just last couple of minutes by saying that I don't want to give too much away about the book, but we should say that you're not completely successful in connecting literally with every single one of these players. But even those instances in which the pursuit is in a sense unsuccessful, those chapters are among the most interesting in the book. And I especially appreciate when you describe pursuing the ultimately elusive Carlton Fisk. You write, with Carlton Fisk, I'm the nerd in high school asking the head cheerleader to the prom and getting flat out rejected. Did you ultimately come to terms with those fleeting moments of disappointment in terms of those connections that you were ultimately unable to make?
Yeah, the book is actually better for not having been successful with all those guys, I think. I mean, at the time, it didn't feel that way, but again, a good story, a good narrative needs to have some kind of dramatic tension and conflict. And so those players, the white whales that I run into that you know, duck me, I think that actually makes it a richer story. It's real, it's authentic, it's representative of life that, you know, you're not going to succeed all the time. And, you know, there's a great line from Don Carmen in the book where he says, or he's paraphrasing the psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, and says, you know, you don't get to write the script in life, you only get to respond. And I think that's maybe the best piece of wisdom in the whole book is the notion that what matters is how you respond to a situation, not the situation itself to begin with.
Hmm. Well, it is an amazing book. I really, really loved it. And I want to add, I'm not really a baseball fan, but I really enjoyed the book just thoroughly. And I'm saying that because I think that not only would a baseball fan love this book or a baseball card collector love this book, but I think a whole lot of people could derive tremendous enjoyment from reading The Wax Pack, On the Open Road in Search of Baseball's Afterlife, published by the University of Nebraska Press, and the author, Brad Baloukjian. Brad Baloukjian, it was a great pleasure to speak with you on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks again for having me, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a COVID update from Carla Nebocosi, who is director of the Health Department for Walworth County. And we'll also be speaking with Dr. Paul Singh, who is president of the eye centers of both Racine and Kenosha. Wednesday, Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College with his monthly visit to the program. On Thursday, best-selling author Deborah Tannen talking about her latest book, about her father. And this Friday, Ted Williams, the author of Earth Almanac, celebrating this 50th anniversary year of Earth Day. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we remind you that the Morning Show is available as a podcast. Look for the Morning Show with Greg Berg at Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, or Spotify. This past weekend's podcast programs included Edward Conlon's wonderful book about police